Here are two new ways that you can promote Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. business card and the Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer. Simply go to the support page at issuesetc.org, click Issues Etc. business cards, print the page on suitable stock paper, and cut along the lines. We also have an 8.5 by 11 inch flyer for the bulletin board at your church. Issuesetc.org, go to the support page, click Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer, and print.
We get accustomed to reading these kind of stories, and we sometimes are so happy just to see that a more orthodox, historic Christian perspective, a biblical perspective, is presented, that we don't pay a lot of attention to how it is presented, the context in which it is presented, and we don't see that sometimes these stories may present both sides, but both sides aren't really answering one another. An example, perhaps from CNN, their religion blog, Can the Christian Crusade Against Pornography Bear Fruit? This is an important issue to deal with, an important thing for secular journalism to write about, but how are they writing about it? Joining us to talk about this recent CNN story about Christians hooked on pornography, Terry Mattingly. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the weekly On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, and he's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
You say that we must read this piece. Why?
Well, two reasons. One is that it's a very important topic. So this is an example of a major branch of the media taking on a major subject. And I would say that in all fairness, you'd have to say that there's a lot of very important information in this piece. The ministry they focus on is important. And I would even say that some of the criticisms of the ministry are important in that they are subjects that need to be debated. However, that brings us to reason number two. I think that people should read this story. And that is, it's a very blatant example of a syndrome that you often see in the press, which in the headline for the piece at Get Religion, I have summed up as smart people versus Bible people. In the sense that what you have what's supposed to look like a balanced journalistic debate in this story, but it's a debate that never occurs. And unless readers pay a lot of attention to what's in the article, it's kind of hard to realize that it never occurs. If I could I think I'll read just a short piece of this in which I describe the methodology of this piece.
Sure.
So stage one, evangelicals described their ministry, which centers on faith in the Bible, etc. Stage two, a smart critic from a name-brand university or seminary speaking on behalf of the vague and omnipresent, quote, many religious scholars, unquote, says that the leaders of the ministry are simplistic and naive in their approach to the Bible and the issues at hand. Stage three, more commentary from the evangelical ministry leaders, but without any direct response from scholars on their side of the biblical issues to the comments of the brilliant name-brand scholar from the secular and or liberal Christian institution. Stage four, more commentary from another critic of the ministry with roots in name-brand academia who does similar work, in this case with believers wrestling with pornography, and believes the evangelicals are naive and simplistic. Finally, last stage, final faith-based words from the evangelicals, once again with no responses to the issues raised by the critics. Now, did you follow that?
It is an argument on one side and perhaps an argument on the other, but neither side is arguing with the other. Am I right?
With the other, because the assumption is that one exists in the world of presumably semi-stupid faith-based Bible answers, and the other is from the world of academia, science, ideas, and intellect. And so how can these two things debate? But you end up with references. One of the ones I jumped on in this little piece is there's a reference to the name brand scholar number one points to scriptural passages that appear to endorse sexual desire, including the Song of Solomon, a poem that some scholars say depicts two lovers graphically describing each other's anatomy in an ode to unmarried sex. Now, I'm not sure that scholars all across the world of Orthodox Judaism, Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, and, say, evangelical Protestantism would all agree that this is a love poem about unmarried sex. I'm not aware of anything in the Song of Solomon that specifically makes it such. But the point here is that the name brand scholar has a brilliant, nuanced, and liberal view of the Bible, whereas these other people don't. That's the key. Now, this could have been an interesting debate. What does the Bible say about desire and lust, which are, by the way, not the same things? You know, and what would scholars on the conservative Catholic, Jewish, Orthodox, Protestant side of the fence say in response to this liberal critic, right? But the story moves on. The story, without any dialogue on this issue, critical issue of what does the Bible actually say on these subjects, you have this brilliant scholar on the left side who speaks, the words are accepted as truth. We now return you to the unthinking, shallow world of the evangelicals talking about the Bible and their ministry. Then later on in the piece, the same thing happens again with another person, in this case a kind of a liberal Protestant who does similar ministry and even has had kind of broken relationships with some of the evangelicals involved. And this person makes a critical statement. This man wants to make it clear he has no association with Blankenship's practice and doesn't agree with some aspects of it. Blankenship doesn't rely enough on psychological expertise, Laser says. The implication is one side is using science, is practicing actual psychology, and the other side is just biblical mumbo-jumbo, and you're expected to pray away your sins. Once again, however, nobody seemed to have asked the evangelical ministry leaders, do you have trained counselors on your team? Do you do psychological evaluations? Do you perhaps work with a counseling center that does psychological evaluations to see if we're dealing with something pathological here? Or, you know, I mean, this person might even be in danger of hurting themselves. The assumption is that because they're praying with their people, they're talking about the Bible, and they're doing Bible stuff, the assumption is that this other ministry isn't doing its psychological homework. Now, I don't know if they are or not, but the story sure as heck fire should have asked them, right?
Could it be that the journalist putting this piece together sincerely believes that the two sides really have nothing whatsoever in common with one another, that they are talking past each other, and therefore doesn't even bother to try and elicit a response from one of the other?
I think that's the assumption. And that's what I meant by saying that I believe that many journalists really don't think that there is such a thing as a conservative Catholic scholar and a conservative evangelical scholar and a Baptist scholar and an Orthodox Jewish scholar. They seem convinced that the intellectual world is automatically progressive. And so thus you have dialogue. I think I like the way you put it. Dialogue isn't possible because these two sides are speaking two different languages. And that just simply isn't the case. It's certainly not the case in Catholicism. It's not the case in Orthodoxy. There are people on different sides of all of these issues, and there are very traditional schools of Bible study, and these people are running around with degrees from Cambridge and Oxford and places in Germany, you know, and whatever, just like the left. They're just teaching in different institutions that perhaps are one or two zip codes further away from newsrooms in New York.
Is this a deficiency in the editor's or the journalist's Rolodex? Is it that they don't know such people exist?
Yes, all of the above. It's very hard to call a phone number if you don't know it exists. And to some degree, it also has to do with the kind of branding that goes on with academia in general. Let me give you a classic and ultimately fatally tragic example. When we were years and years ago when we were talking about the Branch Davidians in Waco. You remember that, of course? Well, the Branch Davidians are actually an offshoot of Adventism and have a long history, you know, related to premillennial and amillennial and millennialism and all this other stuff. Well, so now you've got these people holed up behind a fence outside of Waco, Texas, and the you know, they're surrounded by tanks and machine guns and all this other stuff. Well, where would you go to get academic insights on how you should deal with these people strategically? Where do you think you would go?
Well, I mean, I would start looking for people who could tell me or had an insight into the beliefs behind their behavior.
Those specific beliefs. But
yes.
Where on the map would you go if you were the head of CBS, CNN, and et cetera, et cetera? You'd want the most brilliant people you could find.
I would be looking for probably professors of religion or professors of religious history, something
yes.
along those lines.
Now, would you go, in the case of the Branch Davidians, outside of Waco, Texas, who do you think would probably know more about deviant or vague, confused, different, millennial interpretations? Would you head straight to the Harvard Divinity School, or would you assume that somebody at Baylor University, 15 miles away, probably knows them?
Well, when we come back, let's pick up right there with Terry Mattingly. Yes, perhaps Baylor University was tragically overlooked by the press back then when the Branch Davidians were making the news. You know, I would assume that Baylor would have a religion department. I would assume that being so close to the Branch Davidians, someone there might have been studying the Branch Davidians. There might be someone there that the press could very easily, within a few minutes' drive, find and locate and talk to about the Branch Davidians. Did they? Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about a recent CNN story about Christians hooked on pornography and media coverage of these kinds of issues and how the media covers them. More with him after this.
This is Kate in Japan, and I'm commenting on the program you had about the Unification Church.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
The most important point is to say I love your show and thank you for doing what you do. Bye from Japan.
Old theology, new technology, Issues Etc. worldwide. Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org.
Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Mourning the death of a founder of NARAL?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The National Abortion Rights Action League has been promoting abortion since its founding. Today, we mourn the death of one of its founders, Dr. Bernard Nathanson. He and Betty Friedan founded NARAL in 1968. But in 1970, after seeing an ultrasound of an unborn baby, he became an outspoken opponent of abortion. His short film, The Silent Scream, which includes ultrasound video of an unborn baby screaming in pain during an abortion, rejuvenated the pro-life movement in the 1980s. President Ronald Reagan even showed the film in the White House. Dr. Nathanson died in February at age 84.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Thursday afternoon, August the 25th. A few more minutes with Terry Mattingly talking about how the press generally covers debates between two different factions, liberal and conservative, in Christianity. After our conversation with Terry Mattingly, Pastor David Peterson will join us. We'll be talking about St. Augustine and his mother. They are remembered a little bit later this week on two consecutive days by the church. St. Augustine, obviously a giant, but many historians said he would not be the giant that he was without his mother, Monica. Pastor David Peterson in a few minutes here on Issues Etc. Terry, back to where we left off. We were discussing how Baylor University was overlooked initially by the press back when the Branch Davidians were in the news. Now, I would assume that Baylor would have someone on staff who could speak to that particular issue.
Oh, you mean like a 25-year dialogue with the Branch Davidians, including the man who was the head of the compound and whose wife ended up marrying the guy that went crazy and got them all shot up? I actually spoke to one of my classes when I was a student in contemporary religious movements at Baylor. You know, and Baylor professors actually have 25 years of dialogue, you know, and conversation with these folks off and on. I mean, maybe 25 is an extreme, but I know it had been going on for more than a generation since they relocated to that point. And besides, who do you think probably knows more about variations on millennial beliefs? Somebody in the Harvard Divinity School or someone who's been around the Baptist Wars over millennialism? Right? So to make a long story short here, I sound like I'm browbeating you, but I'm doing it for entertainment value. Needless to say, the next thing you know, there's somebody up on the screen from Harvard explaining, you know, strange branches of Protestantism and these religious movements with absolutely no insights into the history of this group of Branch Davidians. And until long after the fact, nobody thought, you know what? There's like a 10,000-student university sitting over there. I wonder if Baylor University, the largest Baptist institution in the world, has a religion department. I'm being sarcastic, but can you see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
It's like they didn't think that there was intellectual insights that could be gained at Baylor, let alone that scholars at Baylor who want to do new, emerging academic commentaries, papers, etc., might have actually taken an opportunity to dialogue and to study and research the Branch Davidians who are 15 to 20 miles from their campus. Of course they had talked to these people. Well, I would argue that in many ways, the U.S. government's actual misinterpretations of the Branch Davidians, leading to the death of, you know, I do not remember the specific figure, but dozens of people in that compound died in this standoff because nobody took carefully what sort of millennial beliefs could, you know, could lead to a fatal standoff. Well, in this case, I think there's a possibility that thing could have been peaceably solved, or at least the leadership could have been pulled out. I'm not sure all those people needed to die if the U.S. government had done a better job of finding out what they actually believed. And I'm willing to even assign a little bit of blame to say our media didn't do much to tell America what those people believed.
Before we let you go, Terry, give us a kind of a thumbnail way of detecting, as non-journalists, when a story like the one we've referenced here at the beginning of our conversation is presenting two sides without allowing the two sides to interact with one another.
Well, one thing to do is that whenever you see somebody who is quoted from a biblical scholarship position, or somebody from this academic world, immediately try to see if that person has a pair, if there is a partner, someone from the other side to debate that issue. If not, in other words, you could be looking at this like pastor in a pulpit versus scholar, pastor in a pulpit, scholar, pastor in the pulpit. This is like saying shallow people versus supposedly deep people. The same mechanism occurs frequently in let's say, you could see it sometimes in stories about the pro-life movement, where you have academic experts and lawyers called in from only one side of the issue instead of having a dialogue between both sides. You will see this in religious liberty issues, perhaps things involving, say, gay marriage or something. You'll have a brilliant lawyer with Supreme Court roots or something on one side of the issue, and then you never meet anybody from a major law school who happens to have beliefs on the other side of the issue. Yet at the court, there are stacks of briefs being written by people on both sides out of legal institutions, right? Why are we only hearing from the brains on one side of these stories? I actually have my students do this sometimes with colored markers, you know, with highlighter pens. Go through the story and mark normal people versus brainy people, and then see how this story is structured. And by the way, I'm not assuming the normal people don't have brains. What I'm saying is that that's not why they're in the story. They're the folksy, ordinary person who's doing Bible-based ministry. And now we bring in an intellectual, right? It's a very common problem in journalism, in a host of subjects, but religion is my beat, so that's why I'm going to keep shouting about this one.
Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the weekly On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, and he's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here again.